18, the young Qasim left school and began working on a construction site in a different town to help support his family financially. Over the course of the next decade, he also took part in revolutionary activities against the regime of the Shah. In 1979, when Imam Ruhollah Khomeini led the Islamic Revolution to victory, Haj Qasim joined the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Despite minimal training, he showed great talent and natural aptitude and rose up the ranks quickly. The following year, in 1980, when Saddam's Iraqi army invaded Iran, a 23-year-old Qasim joined the battle, and as a company leader, he trained and led a group of volunteers from his home district of Kirman into battle. In a quote attributed to Haj Qasim, he says, "I entered the Iran-Iraq War on a 15-day mission and ended up staying until the end." He fought in multiple battles over the course of the war, receiving serious injuries in the Battle of Tariq al-Quds, close to the border with Iraq. After the end of the war, he was deployed in Kirman province, his area of birth, where he garnered a reputation as a formidable combatant against rampant drug smuggling in the region. In the late 90s, he was appointed as the head of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, a unit dedicated to liberating al-Quds, and spent the following years building up the organization's capabilities and relationships across the region. It was in this role as leader of the Quds Force that he assisted Lebanon in firstly expelling the Israeli occupation in the year 2000, and then in defeating them again during the July War of 2006. But perhaps his greatest victory was in being the person most responsible for the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group, who had taken over huge swaths of territory in Syria and Iraq in 2014. His leadership on the battlefield and his subsequent support for groups trying to expel occupying American forces from West Asia cemented him as a legend amongst the people of the region, while also putting him square in the crosshairs of the mass-murdering US empire and its local lackeys.
Joining us on the show this week to discuss this huge figure are two very special guests. We are honoured to be joined by Masoud Shajareh, the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission and a lifelong activist and humanitarian campaigner who's dedicated himself to fighting the racist and genocidal ideology that is Zionism. Also joining us from Tehran is Brother Ali Salam, who's a convert to Islam and editor-in-chief of Basira Press, with a focus on West Asian affairs, reporting on global capitalism and the Great Reset. Welcome to you both. I'd like to start here in the studio with yourself, Haj Masoud. And let's begin by asking the person, the man, Haj Qasim Soleimani, what did he represent for you?
He represented sort of an ideology of a man who was dedicated as a Muslim to bring justice and peace and tranquility to all his surrounding. And from the early age, when he sort of joined the military at the time of the 8 years imposed war, he actually was trained and his ideology was developed to bring peace and tranquility while the colonial powers around the world are actually committed to exact opposite, because they wanted to destroy the tranquility of not just what's happening in Iran and Iraq, but the whole region. So their interest is actually exact opposite, and his interest was to bring peace and tranquility to all.
And Brother Ali in Tehran, if I could just turn to you as well and ask you the same question in terms of the personality of Qasim Soleimani. What did he mean to you?
I grew up in the U.S., and I grew up in a non-Muslim background. So there are really no heroes, no real role models that they offer for people to emulate. It's almost like a bankruptcy. Your role models are mostly actually fictional characters that are cartoons or now CGI characters. And even beyond that, the real-life people that they tell you to venerate, like celebrities and actors, they have no morality. They're adulterers, they're drug abusers, they're womanizers, they objectify women, they may even be LGBT and other kinds of sexual perverted behaviors. There's nothing good to benefit from them. They're all selfish and materialistic. here is a real hero, a real life hero that even the best fiction writers, script writers, any kind of artist or novelist, they couldn't even come up with it in their imagination. This is a real hero, a complete man who is filled with morality, divine morality, who does everything sincerely for the sake of God without any expecting any materialistic rewards or anything of the sort. So it's a real breath of fresh air to have a hero such as Qasem Soleimani to have as a role model. And when he dies an honorable death, that itself is also a source of being a role model and heroism, because if you look at some of the heroes of the West, like Elvis Presley, he died, excuse my language, but he died on a toilet, on drugs, obese and overweight from junk food. This is a dishonorable death. Qasem Soleimani, even his death is honorable. Even his death is an example. So it's a huge role model, not just for Muslim people, but I think for all people of the world who are thirsty for a real life and a true life.
Absolutely. Thank you, Brother Ali. And if I turn back to you, Haj Mas'ud. Now, you know, there's much been said about the contributions of Haj Qasem in the battlefield. And in particular, he was rather skilled, it would appear, at building coalitions with other groups and also with minorities. You know, what kind of work did he do, for example, with the Christian community in places like Iraq and Lebanon and Syria and so on?
As I said, I mean, really, it's his motivation wasn't us and them. That concept, which is very sort of prominent in the West, you know, first is us and Red Indians and so forth and so on, and, you know, justice comes as oppressing others and so forth. He really wanted to create an environment, of healthy environment, where humanity could actually survive and flourish. And he did that. He did that by addressing the injustices that he came across, even in the middle of battlefield. I mean, you know, I want to remind all of us when he was talking to his soldiers and saying that there are these Zaydis, sort of women and children who are there, oppressed. Our job is to go and free them. They're waiting for us. He was motivating not just himself, but the whole of his army and his supporters towards that direction of addressing injustices, saving innocent, giving right to the oppressed. And that was really a fantastic sort of model based on Islamic sort of principles. You know, it was almost like going back at the time of the companions of the Prophet ﷺ, how the Prophet was teaching them to be effective in addressing injustice through everything, even in the middle of the battlefield. And I think from that point of view, he was a model, not just, as the brother said, not just for us as Muslims, but indeed for the whole world.
Absolutely. And again, back to you, Brother Ali. How exactly did Haj Qasem work with, you know, these minority groups? Let's say, for example, we had examples of Christian fighting groups in the Hashd al-Sha'bi in Iraq, who are, of course, joined in the battle against the Takfiri, Daesh and other groups. You know, what was Haj Qasem's role in reaching out to these people and, you know, reaching into the teachings of Islam to do so?
In Surah Maida, I believe it's Ayah 82, it says that Christians are closest in affection to the Muslims because they have monks among them and they are not arrogant. So I believe, Allah knows best, but I believe that these verses struck well with the heart of Haj Qasem, in addition to the fact that they were being oppressed, and as our guest said, he's for helping people to have lives of dignity free of oppression, no matter who they are. But naturally, this is a special group that's close to Muslims, and if they were able to participate in their own liberation, to not just sit on the sideline, to teach them how to defend themselves so that they can be self-sufficient on their own whenever, God forbid, a tragedy such as this happens, such as ISIS or other such groups, that they are part of their struggle, and they learn this principle of self-determination and resistance against oppression, and not just sitting down and letting it happen. And it's perfectly clear now, after all the documents have been revealed, that the Mossad and CIA and MI6 were the ones who created ISIS. So as much as the Western governments and the Zionist governments pretend like they care about Christians, oh, we need to, these barbaric Muslims are beheading Christians. Well, who's the one that funded them? Who's the one that created them? Who's the one that gave them weapons and logistics? And who's the one that called them moderate freedom fighters and believed all the crocodile tears that they were crying about being oppressed? When it was Haj Qasim who saved the Christians of Mosul through the Hashd al-Shaabi, which he worked with also with Shahid Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, rahmatullah alayh, and also in Lebanon with helping Hezbollah and the Syrian Arab army to liberate some of the Christian villages of Syria who still speak Aramaic, including monasteries, saving them from ISIS besiegement. In fact, it was Hezbollah and the Syrian Arab army that were responsible for liberating the ancient village of Ma'lula, which you never hear on the Zionist media. You never hear that these are the people that saved Christians, especially these anti-Islam characters in the West, like Geert Wilders or Tommy Robinson, who get Zionist funding, as we have seen from the research of a British politician named Nick Griffin. He exposed Tommy Robinson. Why doesn't he thank Qasem Soleimani for saving the Christians that he pretends that people like Robinson pretend to care about? This is a grave hypocrisy. And so anybody who's listening, who truly cares about the Christians, who truly cares about the Christians in Syria, they should be thanking Hezbollah. They should be thanking Shahid Qasem Soleimani.
Sure. Thank you, Ali. Now, let's take a look at Haj Qasem's legacy in relation to supporting the struggle of the Palestinian people.
The fact that Soleimani was commander of the Quds Force tells you the centrality of the Palestinian force to General Soleimani. He quickly opened the Palestinian and the Lebanese resistance files and led, essentially, the coordination between the Quds Force and all the Palestinian factions across the board. So both the Islamic, so that's Hamas and Jihad, as well as the left wing, so the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the General Committee, etc., in a way in which they were coordinated and they weren't separated. Osama Hamdan stated that any Palestinian faction, under the title of requiring weapons for resistance, Haj Qasem did not show fault in shipping those weapons. And also the prisoners was a file that was considered of utmost priority. So you had an occupation soldier, Gilad Shalit, who was captured as part of a prisoner exchange. 1,000 Palestinian prisoners were released, one of whom was actually Yahya Sinwar, who's the current Hamas leader in Gaza. And then if we look further to 2008, when Operation Calf-Led occurred, this war essentially presented an opportunity to experiment those resistance capabilities that began in 2000, that was strengthened with the liberation of Gaza in 2005, which ultimately transformed Gaza from this very weak strip to one of the Israeli occupation entity's most overarching objectives, to defeat Hamas. That was back 15 years ago. Imagine, the Israeli occupation entity is still on the same objective and still cannot defeat it today. So in the words of, you know, Abu Ahmed Fuad, who is the Secretary of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, you know, he stated that Soleimani did not differentiate between sects and ideologies, only between factions who wanted to fight the occupation and those who wanted to surrender. And if you look at the activities and the involvement of Soleimani, it went beyond just Palestine. You know, he sought and he reached out even to the Taliban, you know, to curb the more extreme factions within them, which turned Taliban from an ISIS-like entity to one that was much more moderate and much more controlled. You know, he even visited, you know, President Putin to secure Russia's involvement in the fight against the ISIS terrorists in Syria, thanks to which, you know, the black flags of ISIS are not reigning over Damascus today. And likewise with the situation of the Kurds in Kirkuk, for example, leading to the Kurdish withdrawal from there, so that there's no infighting between the Iraqi troops and the Kurdish troops. You know, that is the general trajectory of someone like General Soleimani. It is one in which he represents the ideals of the Islamic Revolution, which is to have an open hand policy to support on the basis of causes. It is the causes that unite. And ultimately, this way, this free thinking, this open hand is contagious and it attracts all the free thinkers of the world.
Now, if I can come back to you, Brother Mas'ud. Now, there are some who are critics of Haj Qasem and especially the role he played in fighting Takfiri terrorist groups in places like Syria and Iraq, who accuse him of being sectarian. Do you think that that's a fair accusation? Is that true? Did that reflect his worldview, his religious view, and how he viewed Muslims from other schools of thought?
No, it isn't. I mean, when you look at, if you want to really look at his legacy, we need to look at who mourned him. You know, when you look at in Syria, in Iraq, and across the world, Muslims, Christians, and people of all different faiths and background, and the secularists, they all mourned because they actually saw that they lost someone who was addressing their issue, the issue of their security. And especially people in Iraq and people in Syria and elsewhere who were the real victims of this sort of chaos which was created by the West and their agents in the region. So really, I don't think we should sort of wait and hear from United States or Europe, Quango sitting down trying to judge someone like Sadr Soleimani. But Sadr Soleimani should be judged by those oppressed people, the voice of those oppressed people in Iraq, in Syria, and elsewhere, who saw in him a savior of creating a juster and fairer society for all of them. And that's how he managed to mobilize everyone for creating a better society for all of them. That is not a work of sectarianism. That is not a work of separation and division.
And as we saw just previously, and the role he played in Palestine as well, which is primarily a Sunni population, if you will, who have reached out and thanked both Haj Qasim and the Islamic Republic of Iran for their support in assisting them in their struggle as well.
Absolutely. Basically, what we see on one side, oppressed people around the world are his supporter, and then the oppressors are his enemies. And I think that actually says very well what sort of man he was.
Absolutely. Brother Ali, I want to come to you with this question, because I know your background, you have converted or reverted to the religion of Islam, and you came from a Jewish background, and someone like Haj Qasim is accused of being anti-Jewish. Do you think this is a fair reflection of his position?
No, I believe it's a totally unfair position, and I believe it's a slander of his noble character, because he's an adherent to the religion of Islam in its purest form. And the religion of Islam does not believe in biological determinism. It doesn't believe in viewing the world from a racialist lens. So it doesn't have the problem with the ethnic background of people. It's mainly concerned with people's actions and, to an extent, the beliefs that may fuel those actions. So in the Islamic Republic of Iran, Jews are allowed to live in peace. Now, we as Muslims believe that Islam is the only religion that's undistorted. The other religions have been distorted over time to one degree or another, some more than others. And we know that the Torah is not the same as it was as the angel Gabriel revealed it to Prophet Moses, peace be upon him. And Islam accepts all of the Israelite and Hebrew prophets and accepts that the Torah in its unadulterated form would be the truth. So if the adherents of a corrupted version of the Torah maybe believe in racism, or maybe that they should, because of this racism, they, for example, should do usury on the inferior races, well, usury is illegal in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and it doesn't matter who is the one charging the usury. They're all going to get the same punishment. The law is equal to all the people. So it's not like people are specifically targeted just because they were born a certain way. That's irrational. Islam is against injustice and irrationality. Being racist is totally irrational because people cannot change how they are born, but they can change how they act. And so in that sense, Shahid Soleimani did not persecute any group unfairly, and the Jewish group, whether in Iran or elsewhere, is not the case. And in the case of the Zionist regime, they're being targeted because they're military occupiers. If they were Italian, if they were Eskimos from Alaska, it would be the same reaction.
And Brother Ali, I just want to stay with you and ask a question about the comrade and brother-in-arms of Haj Qasim Soleimani, Abu Mehdi Mohandas, who also attained Shahada on that same fateful evening. What more can we learn about his life and his approach to protecting those kinds of minority groups in the region?
Well, since it really spoiled the plans of the Americans and the Zionists to create sectarianism in the region, especially Iraq. During the early days of the Iraq invasion, various Zionist neocons and American neocons in Washington, D.C. were drafting up plans on how to split Iraq into several mini-statelets to basically balkanize Iraq according to ethnic and sectarian lines. And this is a realization of the Oded Yunon plan of the Zionist regime going back to the 1980s, that in order to weaken resistance to the Zionist regime, they must divide and conquer according to ethnic and sectarian lines. So they would have an ethnic Kurdish state and a sectarian Sunni state and a sectarian Shia state. So in his life, Shahid Abu Mahdi totally refused this plan by avoiding sectarianism. And you see how he organized the Hashd al-Shaabi, where there were Christians in serving. They had a regiment of Christians, or even they had mixed regiments. I believe there was one that was called like Imam Ali, Virgin Mary, or Jesus, or Messiah Jesus Brigade. So it may have been a mixed brigade. And then in his death, like there was at the time, even some months before, there was riots in Iraq. They were trying to do various plots to pit Iraqis against the Iranians, even though they are all Shia. His death totally eliminated that, and we really haven't seen such plots spring up since, subhanAllah. So it's in his life and in his death, he implemented unity among the people, which is very beautiful.
Absolutely. Thank you, Brother Ali. And now, just finally, very quickly, Hajj Mas'ud, we wanted to also discuss the circumstances around the assassination and the legality of it. I mean, this was something which was totally out of the bounds of any type of moral or international law.
Well, this is actually very important, because what we are seeing is that the arrogance of U.S. Arrogance is to go around, be judge, jury and executioner, using use of drone to assassinate people against international law, against national laws. And the reality is that, you know, they're murdering huge number of people. Their own report says that 70% of people who are killed and assassinated by drones are innocent. But the reality is that they're all innocent, because they were never taken to court. They were never being put the accusation against them. It's just the assassination by big power, United States and Israelis, who actually just want to go and take people out. This is unlawful, and it has to stop. If it doesn't, then becomes the law of jungle. Then everybody will go and kill everybody as they wish. And we will have no international law, no justice, and a chaos. So really, to address that issue is very important. This action, and indeed other actions, have been totally unlawful, and someone needs to be brought to justice.
Brother Mas'ud, thank you so much. And also Brother Ali in Tehran, thank you so much as well. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Thank you at home as well. And you can join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The conversation.
Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at Operation Banner, the name attributed to the British Army's role during the conflict between 1969 until it officially ended in 2007. My next guest served in various units of the British Army during this period and later became a member of Veterans for Peace. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh, South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and Chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Glenn Bradley. Glenn is a former British soldier who later became an officer in the Ulster Unionist Party, participating in the talks that led to the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. Glenn continues to engage in various initiatives to advance peace, reconciliation, and evolve political thinking on the island of Ireland. Glenn Bradley, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gar Milimiogat.
Glenn, you grew up on the Shangle Road, not far from where we're actually sitting right now. Can you tell us a bit about your childhood?
First thing is, if I'd said I grew up on the Shangle Road, my granny would have beat me. I grew up on the Woodville Road, which is the top end of the Shankill. I was born in 1967 into a left-leaning, socialist-leaning, working-class family in a poverty-stricken street, two up, two down, terraced house, tin bath on the wall, no running hot water. My inheritance in life was that I was born into a loyal Irish family. What do I mean by loyal Irish? I mean that we looked eastwards for our sovereignty. We were the Irish dimension along with Welsh, English and Scots that made up the British nation, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And that is the politic that I was born into, a very hearthly home, but where politics was daily discussed, largely as a consequence of the poverty that surrounded us all. Poverty reigned in the area. Obviously, being born in 1967, it was also on the cusp of the civil uprising that was happening here in Northern Ireland. And while I had nothing to do with the previous 50 years of the Orange State and what had happened, I certainly was born into that era of violence. And in actual fact, until the ceasefires of 1994 and 1997, I knew only violence in my life. So I grew up with daily armed violence all around me on an everyday basis. You know, our days were spent listening to bombs, listening to gunfire, armed patrols on the street, para-aggression, provisional IRA aggression against my community, loyalist paramilitary violence against my community every single day on our streets.
So what motivated you then, Glenn, to join the British Army? I too grew up in a very political house and politics was discussed daily as well. We also would have understood poverty, mm-hmm. but equality and opportunities and things like that were what we were talking about. It was how we were treated compared to our neighbours a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. As far as I was concerned, I had grown up in a community that was under physical attack by the IRA. You know, day and daily, it was armed aggression against my community, and we were being failed by the RUC. We were being failed by the British Army. And in 1972,
age five. I was injured in an IRA no warning car bomb. And in that small community that I come from, we knew lots of people who were getting injured. We knew lots of people who were getting killed. And it really came to a head for me on the day that Bobby Sands died. When Bobby died during that May period, you know, I was attending the Belfast Boys Model School, and our school bus was returning. Nationalists and Republicans had formed a gauntlet at the Ardoyne roundabout, and they petrol bombed our school bus. And there was lots of derogatory language being shouted, you know, burn you hun this, and so on and so forth. And but for the bravery of the bus driver on the day, who put his foot to the accelerator and actually mounted the Ardoyne roundabout and got us to the relative safety of Woodville Road, you know, the casualties would have been far higher. But it's the first day that I remember seething hatred in me. You know, I get off that bus and looking back up towards the roundabout, you know, my thought was, I'm going to kill yous. I am going to kill yous. And I was 14 years of age. And there's hundreds of thousands of other people would have joined the British Army without this motivation, but my motivation as a 16-year-old was quite naive at the time. You know, I was a kid who had grown up in a very closeted and tight-knit community, who was sectarian in my thinking, who believed that the Northern Ireland conflict was wholly and solely about my community and getting raped by IRA violence. And I felt that the only way that violence could be stopped was to be met by other violence. And then I naively joined the British Army thinking, I'll get the best training possible and go back to Northern Ireland and take the fight to the enemy. At 16 years of age. The British Army is one of three armies in the world that recruits children into its ranks, and it is entirely legal for 16-year-olds, even now, today, in 2023. I'm talking 1984, but a child of age 16 can join the British Army.
So you joined the British Army. I mean, what was the first regiment to join? Because I understand you were in various regiments.
Yeah, I initially enlisted into the Parachute Regiment, but I also served with the Royal Irish Rangers, 1st Battalion of the Royal Irish Rangers, and I also did special duty tours during Operation Banner, which would be specific to my deployments in Northern Ireland. I actually did five tours in Northern Ireland.
So, Glenn, you said you joined the British Army to get the best training. Does that mean you had an urge to join a loyalist paramilitary group, or is that what you were thinking?
As a teenager, there is no doubt that I considered joining the 1st Battalion of the Ulster Volunteer Force, the UVF, which would be a loyalist paramilitary group. You know, I come from a family that is steeped in the tradition of the UVF, and it would have been very easy, particularly with the area that I live in, for me to join B Company. But my uncle, who was a local politician at the time in the Progressive Unionist Party, put the vibes out to make sure that if I approached anyone, which I tried to do, that I would be declined the offer to enlist into the UVF. And so, yes, enlisting into a paramilitary, loyalist paramilitary, did cross my mind. But it wasn't a viable option for me because concerned relatives made sure that that course of action that would only lead to death or prison wasn't available to me. You know, that the army was the lesser of two evils, so to speak, and I was encouraged to join the British Army.
You joined the British Army. Just cut forward and on a little bit. You then, when you retired from the army, you joined the Ulster Unionist Party.
For me, the murder of my uncle, D.C. Louis Robinson, in September 1990, played heavily on me. You know, that was within our tactical area of responsibility. The 2nd Battalion, the Royal Irish Rangers, were serving as ARB, and Louis was abducted in their area. So there I was.
Do you just want to tell a bit about that, Glenn?
My uncle was Detective Constable Louis Robinson of the RUC. He had been fishing down in County Kerry, was coming back home, crossing the border. When the IRA, posing as UDR soldiers, abducted him. They held him for 3 days, torturing him, before hooding him and executing him. And that all happened within the TAOR of the regiment that I was in, the Royal Irish Rangers at that time. And I assisted in the search operation to try and locate his body. I wouldn't have said it was a catalytic moment that made me get out of the army, because I went on to do a further 4 years. But there was it, and then I did a six-month tour in Bosnia in 1992. And I think the combination of both those, I was evolving from believing that violence could satisfy things, and I was moving into a reality for me where I believed that violence was futile. And I left the army because of that in 1994.
And then, so you joined the Ulster Unionist Party at that stage then?
Yeah.
Hopes for peace or what?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, but by this stage, I had gone from being a naive kid who worshipped at the high altar of violence to someone who believed that dialogue, engagement, equitable equality were the only things that could resolve the political situation in Northern Ireland. So I landed back here in 1994, back to the Woodville, the area that I came from, and there was no change. There was no change from 1984 to 1984 on the poverty or anything. Nothing was being addressed. It was still the usual fly or traipse a Union Jack over a donkey and put it up for election. It would get election. And I says, no, this can't continue. So I initially, again, funny enough, was going to join the Progressive Unionist Party. But my uncle felt that because of my army service, I would never be trusted. And he said, you'd be better off going into the UUP and you'd probably get further on politically than what you could. So I joined the Ulster Unionist Party. So my motivation at the Good Friday Agreement was to get a peace accord on which we could then build to create equitable equality and address all the imbalances that, in my view, had made Northern Ireland unworkable up to that point. So that was my motivation in being in the Ulster Unionist Party. So it was about, for me, it was about ground truth, community politic, engagement, and addressing the causes of conflict and the reasons for gross poverty in the area that I came from.
And you later became a member of Veterans for Peace. Motivated you to do that?
For me, it was just a natural evolution of the journey and the path that I was on. You know, I go back and I say, you know, I was this naive kid who worshipped at the high altar of violence, and I'd gone through this transition to being this peacenik who simply felt that violence was futile and could achieve nothing. And Veterans for Peace, for me, was my natural home where I could openly discuss who I was, the journey I had been on, but also related to being in the army amongst people who understood my language and who could speak to me. So for me, it was just a natural evolution to join Veterans for Peace.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs around Ireland. I'm joined by our co-host, Michelle Gildernew, alongside our special guest, Glenn Bradley, who served in various regiments of the British Army and is now a member of Veterans for Peace.
Was there one particular event or one incident that sparked that desire to go from a combatant to somebody who promoted and worked towards peace?
Not that I can remember. I can't recall a singular catalytic moment. Obviously, the murder of my Uncle Louis and everything around that, and my service in Bosnia, it bled heavily on me. But there's not a singular event that I can remember that made me go from this rather naive kid that had worshipped at the high altar of violence to being a peacenik. There's just nothing that is singularly correct. You know, I did five tours here And as you know, serving in Fermanagh is entirely different to serving in Belfast, and the duties of the soldier would have done at that time. But what I did identify with them was the belligerence of politicians of that era. And it really, really annoyed me because no one was addressing poverty. Nobody was addressing the causes of conflict. And what I mean by the causes of conflict is, you know, at that period of time, 1986 or whatever it was, I think we had, at that stage, there was probably about 16,000 Republicans and 10,000 Loyalists had been arrested, charged through the process and were in long cash. And, you know, something didn't happen in 1968 to suddenly make, you know, over 26,000 people wake up the next morning and go, we're violent and we're going to do this. Nobody was identifying the causes of conflict, which, in my opinion, also relates to the causes of poverty because they go hand in glove together. And I just had this desire and urge that, again, coming back to what I said earlier about my children, you know, I did not want them to inherit the socio-economic political basket case that I had been born into. And I felt a real duty and responsibility to address the causes of conflict and the reason why Northern Ireland was in such poverty. And not even today, that remains my motivation. The only difference today is I'm now talking about my grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Because as you know, Michelle, there was things agreed in the Good Friday Agreement, things like the Bill of Rights and so mm-hmm. on, that had never, ever been addressed because some politicians here don't want to.
I agree with you, and having been elected in 1998 into the First Assembly, I can tell you now that your worldview is very different from the vast majority of unionist politicians that I worked with, worked in committees, looked at tackling poverty. Some of the unionist politicians up there had no clue about poverty, how it existed, about how young people could end up homelessness. They just had they were tone deaf to the actual problems that we're facing our society.
I think a lot of that is to do with political unionism and what political unionism has been doing for the last 100 years from the creation of this state. You know, as McGrandy used to say, you know, up a shankle you could bring a donkey, traipse a union jack over it and would get elected. And that's what political unionism has been doing for 100 years, you know. Back in 86, it was, 60 years I was talking about. You know, nothing has changed. You know, people from outside the areas are parachuted into the areas and they get elected because of flag waving, because of things that are completely irrelevant to addressing the causes of poverty, the causes of undereducation within the unionist community. And it's an absolute disaster.
And this ethos, if you like, carried you in to business. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Well, it wasn't, obviously I had to work. When I joined the Ulster Unionist Party, it was a voluntary role. You know, you're not paid to be a constituency chairman, you're not paid as the treasurer. It was about activism and it was about trying through the party to address things. So I always worked, and coming from a military background as I did, haulage and supply chains were naturally where I felt at home. So I formed a business in partnership with a guy. We were located in James's Business Park in Finglas, and we created a small cross-border haulage distribution company, and we went very quickly to making decent money.
Glenn, you're a few years older than me, but we basically want the same thing. We want a future for our children and grandchildren that's different to our upbringing. I can't ever envisage that within a six-county administration. How do you feel about how we move into the future in a way? The last 100 years, as you've pointed out, haven't been good for anybody. Society is broken here. I don't know, can it be fixed? But I don't see it ever been fixed within a six-county settlement. What's your views on that?
My view, you know, the Good Friday Agreement is our common denominator, Michelle. It's the common denominator of all the people in this region. You know, and when the people ratified the Good Friday Agreement, it became our mechanism for all political discourse.
Border
Within the Good Friday Agreement, there is the provisions for a what people call a border poll, a referendum, that the people here, of their own vocation, can choose to stay in either United Kingdom, or they can choose to go for something new. That's something new to me is personally more attractive than the current status quo. You know, and within me and my political journey, I think pre-Brexit, I was maybe happy to go along with things. But Brexit irreversibly, irrevocably proved to me that this small place that we call home is of no consideration to Westminster. Because the because political unionism, in my opinion, and keep in mind I come from that tribe, has utterly failed to deliver, to address anything for the last 100 years. The British government has failed to address anything in the last 100 years. And I just am at that stage of life where I'm going, what's to fear from trying something new? Mm-hmm. I don't fear change. You know, my whole life has been about embracing change and evolution. So for me, you know, if the border poll was happening tomorrow, I would be voting to end the union with Britain, and I would be voting to create something anew here in Ireland that is for all of the people of this island, all 2 million of us, that is equal, that delivers equitable equality, that addresses poverty, that addresses social housing needs, that addresses all the issues that for the last 100 years have not been addressed in this statement.
I think on that note, I want to thank you for coming in. It's great to have you today, and it's always good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you both, Garmin and Miyagin.
This week, we take a look at the history of Crumlin Road Jail. While this Victorian-era prison has now been transformed into a public museum, its history is one embedded in the foundations of the state, one where the hangman was always busy.
Built in 1845, Crumlin Road Jail has bore witness to a fraught period of Irish history. In its 150 years, children from impoverished families, political prisoners, and suffragettes were among 25,000 people incarcerated within its walls. The first 106 inmates who were forced to walk from Carrickfergus Prison in chains arrived in 1846. In a city where poverty was rife, children were often jailed for menial offences such as stealing food or clothing. 13-year-old Patrick McGee, who had been sentenced to 3 months in prison, hanged himself in his cell in 1858. That same year, a law was introduced forbidding children under the age of 14 to be sent to an adult prison. Women inmates were kept in the prison blockhouse until the early 1900s. Suffragettes among them, Dorothy Evans and Madge Muir, were imprisoned in the jail during 1914. Before the gallows was built in 1901, executions were carried out in full public view. An execution chamber was then constructed within the prison walls and used until the last of the hangings in 1961. 17 prisoners were executed in the prison, the last being Robert McLattery, who was hanged in 1961 for the murder of Pearl Gamble. The bodies of the executed were buried inside the prison in unconsecrated ground against the back wall beside the prison hospital. The execution of Tom Williams, a 19-year-old member of the IRA, took place on the 2nd of September 1942. He was hanged for the killing of an RUC officer. The hangman in charge was Thomas Pierpoint, the jail's most regular hangman, who carried out 6 executions in the jail between 1928 and 1942. After a long campaign by friends and comrades of Williams, he was disinterred and buried in Milltown Cemetery in the year 2000. Despite being known as Europe's Alcatraz, there were a number of successful escape attempts at the jail. The first recorded escape was in 1866. In May 1941, 5 Irish Republican prisoners made their escape over the walls of freedom. During its 150-year history, the jail had many prisoners pass through its doors. Some of the more well-known prisoners included former Irish Taoiseach Eamon de Valera, former Deputy First Minister Martin McGuinness, and the hunger striker Bobby Sands.
On the 24th of November 1991, during the last stages of the conflict, the Loyalist wing of the prison became the target of a provisional IRA bomb that killed a UVF and UDA prisoner. A rocket attack by Loyalists on the jail in the early 90s was also close to killing a number of Republicans. In 1996, the jail closed its doors for the last time, where it is now used as a museum, becoming a major tourist attraction for the many international visitors to post-conflict Belfast.
And that does it for another week. I'd like to thank our special guest, Glenn Bradley, and my co-host, Michelle Gildernew. In the meantime, The Conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight. While the United States and other Western allies of Israel remain deeply complicit in the genocide of Palestinians, calls have grown louder across the world for the boycott of Israeli companies that aid and abet the genocidal war against the Palestinians in Gaza. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Reuters news agency has covered the story and tells us more. A boycott campaign against Israeli products over the occupying regime's war in the Gaza Strip has severely affected Western fast food giants in several Arab countries, with the move having the potential to spread to other countries across the globe. Months after the Israeli regime waged a brutal war on the besieged Gaza Strip, a boycott campaign against Israeli goods started to gain momentum in Egypt, Jordan, and Turkey, significantly hitting Western fast food giants like McDonald's, Starbucks, and KFC. The impacted companies are either perceived to have taken pro-Israeli stances in the war or are charged to have financial ties to Israel or investments in Israel. 31-year-old Cairo resident Raham Hamed, who is boycotting U.S. fast food chains and some cleaning products, said, "I feel that even if I know this will not have a massive impact on the war, then this is the best we can do as citizens of different nations so we don't feel like our hands are covered in Palestinian blood." As the global pressure is mounting on Tel Aviv over its atrocities in Gaza, there are signs that the boycott campaign is also spreading to some other Arab countries, including Kuwait and Morocco. The boycott calls of the protest campaign have already circulated on social media sites and expanded to include dozens of companies and products, urging shoppers to shift to local alternatives. In Jordan, citizens who support the protest campaign sometimes enter McDonald's and Starbucks branches in the country to encourage a few customers to take their business elsewhere. The current boycott campaign could be considered the latest part of the pro-Palestine boycott, divestment and sanctions, the BDS movement, against the Israeli regime. The boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, which is modelled after anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, was initiated in 2005 by over 170 Palestinian organisations that were pushing for various forms of boycott against Israel until it meets its obligations under international law.
Thousands of volunteers worldwide have since joined the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions movement, which calls for people and groups across the world to cut their economic, cultural and academic ties to the Israeli regime to help promote the Palestinian cause. Newsweek magazine has also covered the same story and tells us more. The chief executive officer of McDonald's, Chris Kempczinski, wrote on a blog and reported by media on Thursday, 4th of January, he wrote, "Several markets in West Asia and some outside the region are experiencing a meaningful business impact due to the war, affecting brands like McDonald's." The Big Burger chain is one of several multinational corporations to be feeling the effects of international boycotts in the wake of Israel's savage campaign in Gaza, which started after the Israeli regime was caught off guard by the surprise Palestinian operation Al-Aqsa Storm on 7th of October. Some Western brands have felt the impact of boycotts in Egypt and Jordan that have now caught on in some countries outside of the Arab region, including Muslim-majority Malaysia. Meanwhile, McDonald's franchise operations is rewriting its future plan for 2024, as Kempczinski described the company's loss to investors as disheartening. He expressed disappointment over the negative impact of the boycotts on business revenue. Kempczinski claimed, "In every country where we operate, McDonald's is represented by local owner-operators who work tirelessly to serve and support their communities while employing thousands of their fellow citizens." He added, "McDonald's and other affected companies are looking for a solution to maintain a balance of global operations amid shifting political landscapes." In the meantime, Google has reinstated a mobile phone application that helps people identify and potentially avoid the products that have been made by companies that are linked to the Israeli regime. The application named No Thanks was made available again on Google's Play Store just days after it was removed. The app was launched recently amid a genocidal war by the Israeli regime on the Palestinians of Gaza, which has so far massacred tens of thousands of innocent people. The developer of the app, named Ahmad Bashbash, is a Hungary-based Palestinian from Gaza who has lost his siblings to the Israeli campaign of bloodletting against the coastal sliver. Ahmad Bashbash told German broadcaster Deutsche Welle, "I made it, the app, on behalf of my brother and my sister who I lost because of this brutal occupation, and my goal is to try to prevent what happened to me from happening to other Palestinians." The app No Thanks allows customers to scan products' barcodes and be notified if they have been made by Israeli companies. The English website of Al Mayadeen Television Network has also covered the same story. Islamic Human Rights Commission has launched a massive campaign seeking a boycott of those governments and companies that support the ongoing Israeli genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. In a statement released recently, the non-profit organization, the Islamic Human Rights Commission, based in London, said Israel has now been committing genocide openly in front of the world's eyes. It further said that the United Kingdom and other Western governments were complicit in the ongoing genocide by the Israeli regime against Palestinians of Gaza, adding that our governments are refusing to support a ceasefire to end the genocide. Instead, they are cheerleading the slaughter of Palestinians, providing arms and political cover to the Israeli regime. The Islamic Human Rights Commission noted, "We must act now to do whatever we can to oppose this genocide. One of the easiest things to do is to boycott those that support genocide. There are many companies that support Israel and deserve to be boycotted, but this list of companies we have researched below is particularly despicable in that they have ramped up their support for Israel, often specifically for the military, whilst it commits genocide in Gaza in front of our own eyes.